this because I'm not saying it's your fault, but I just think it's something that working together we need to resolve. And this is something I think that Congress has to play a part in. If you don't have the money, if you don't have the resources, we cannot tolerate a backlog in FISA applications if it can be fixed mechanically.
I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that question, Senator. I will say that the staff, our staff at the Department of Justice, these are the experts in the FISA process, has in essence tripled since 2002. I think we all realize, following the attacks of 9/11, that we needed to get more folks on board to help us with the FISA application. It still takes too long, in my judgment, to get FISAs approved. I've described in my opening statement the process that's involved here. FISA applications are often an inch thick, and it requires a sign-off by analysts at an NSA, lawyers at an NSA, lawyers at the department, and finally me, and then it's got to be approved by the FISA court. I've got to tell you, I was going to try to make this point in response to a question from the chairman. The members of the FISA court are heroes, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, they're available day or night. They're working on weekends and holidays because they want to make themselves available. They're killing themselves, quite frankly, making themselves available to be there to sign off on a FISA application if it meets the requirements of the statute. But we still have some problems. It is true that because of the procedures that are in FISA, it inherently is going to result in some kind of delay. And for that reason, the president made the determination that for certain very narrow circumstances, he's going to authorize the terrorist surveillance program. But we continue to work at it, and I know you're very interested in this, and I look forward to continuing to have discussions with you about it.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Attorney General. It is something that continues to trouble me. Putting aside the issue that we're here about today, FISA is a matter of national security. And I'm still hearing things that frankly disturb me. And it's just a question of whether this can be sped up. And if some things are inherent, as you say, but I get the impression that part of the problem is not inherent and could be fixed.
Well, one of the things that hopefully will happen soon is the creation of a new national security division. As you know, the Patriot Act has a provision in it which creates a new assistant attorney general for the national security division. We believe that division will assist in the streamlining of the FISA process.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
Senator Feinstein.
Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California, but Attorney General Gonzalez.
I'm sorry. Could I make one point in response to Senator Cole? I made this point, but I want to make sure that the committee understands this in terms of domestic-to-domestic al-Qaeda communications. I said that we're using other authorities. I mean, to the extent we can engage in intercepting al-Qaeda domestic-to-domestic calls, even under FISA, if we can do it, we're doing it. So I don't want the American people to believe that we're doing absolutely nothing about al-Qaeda domestic-to-domestic calls. The president made a determination this is where the line's going to be, and so we operate within those boundaries. And so we take advantage of the tools that are out there. And if FISA isn't always the most efficient way to deal with that, but if that's all we have, that's what we use. So I guess I want to make sure the American people understand that we're not simply ignoring domestic-to-domestic communications of al-Qaeda. We're going after it.
Thank you, Attorney General Gonzalez, for that clarification. Senator Feinstein.
Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California.
Chairman, I'd like to make clear that, for me at least, this hearing isn't about whether our nation should aggressively combat terrorism. I think we all agree on that. And it's not about whether we should use sophisticated electronic surveillance to learn about terrorist plans, intentions, and capabilities. We all agree on that. And it's not about whether we should use those techniques inside the United States to guard against attacks. We all agree on that. But this administration is effectively saying, and the Attorney General has said it today, it doesn't have to follow the law. And this, Mr. Attorney General, I believe, is a very slippery slope. it's fraught with consequences. The intelligence committees have not been briefed on the scope and nature of the program. They have not been able to explore what is a link or an affiliate to Al-Qaeda or what minimization procedures are in place. We know nothing about the program other than what we've read in the newspapers. And so it comes with huge shock, as Senator Leahy said, that the President of the United States in Buffalo, New York in 2004 would say, and I quote, "Anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, it requires, a wiretap requires a court order." Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so. Mr. Attorney General, in light of what you and the President have said in the past month, this statement appears to be false. Do you agree?
No, I don't, Senator. In fact, I take great issue with your suggestion that somehow the President of the United States was not being totally forthcoming with the American people. I have his statement. And in the sentence immediately before what you're talking about, he said he was referring to roving wiretaps. And so I think anyone who
So you're saying that statement only relates to roving wiretaps.
Senator, that speech was about that discussion was about the Patriot Act. And right before he uttered those words that you're referring to, he said, secondly, there are such things as roving wiretaps. You know, now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretaps, it requires a wiretap, requires a court order. So, as you know, the president is not a lawyer, but this was a discussion about the Patriot Act. This was a discussion about roving wiretaps, and I think some people are trying to take part of his statement out of context, and I think that's unfair.
Okay, fair enough. Let me move along. In October 2002, at a public hearing of the Senate-House Joint Inquiry into NSA activities, the then NSA Director General Michael Hayden told me, quote, "If at times I seem indirect or incomplete, I hope that you and the public understand that I have discussed our operations fully and unreservedly in earlier closed sessions." As I mentioned, the Intelligence Committee has not been notified. Let me ask you this. If the President determined that a truthful answer to questions posed by the Congress to you, including the questions I ask here today, would hinder his ability to function as Commander-in-Chief, does the authorization for use of military force or his asserted plenary powers authorize you to provide false or misleading answers to such questions?
Absolutely not, Senator. Of course not. Nothing
Thank
would,
you.
Would
just
excuse
question,
false
yes no.
statements before the Congress.
All right. You have advanced what I think is a radical legal theory here today. The theory compels the conclusion that the President's power to defend the nation is unchecked by law, that he acts alone and according to his own discretion, and that the Congress's role, at best, is advisory. You say that the authorization for use of military force allows the President to circumvent the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that if the AMUF doesn't, then the Constitution does. Senator Daschle has testified that when he was majority leader, the administration came to him shortly before the AMUF came to the floor and asks that the words "inside the United States" be added to the authorization, and that he said absolutely not, and it was withdrawn. The question I have is, how do you interpret congressional intent from the passage of the AUMF that it gave the administration the authority to order electronic surveillance of Americans in contravention to the FISA law?
Senator, it is not in contravention of the FISA law. We believe the authorization to use military force is the kind of congressional action that the FISA law anticipated. It has never been our position that we are that somehow the AUMF amended FISA. It's never been our position that somehow FISA has been overridden. Quite the contrary, we believe that the President's authorizations are fully consistent with the provisions of FISA.
Now, let me stop you just for a second. I read the FISA law. There are only two escape hatches. One is 15 days after a declaration of war, and the second is the 72-hour provision, which was actually amended by us in the Patriot Act from a lower number to 72 hours. Those are the only two escape hatches in FISA. What in FISA specifically, then, allows you to conduct electronic surveillance within America on Americans?
I believe that it's Section 109.
That's right.
Which talks about persons not engaged in electronic surveillance under color of law except as authorized by statute. Now, I may not have it exactly right. We believe that is the provision in the statute which allows us to rely upon the authorization to use military force. Now, you may say, well, that I disagree with that construction. That may be so. There may be other constructions that may be fairly possible. We believe this is a fairly possible reading of FISA. And as the Supreme Court has said, in terms of under the canon of constitutional avoidance, if you have two possible constructions of a statute, and one would result in raising a constitutional issue, if the other interpretation is one that is fairly possible, that is the interpretation that must be applied. And if you reject our interpretation of FISA, Senator, then you have a situation where you've got an act of Congress in tension with the President's constitutional authority as Commander-in-Chief. And the Supreme Court said when that happens, you go with another interpretation if it's a fair application, and that's what we've done here.
Could you check your citation? I just read 109, and
okay.
I don't believe it says that. We'll talk about that after lunch. Let me go on and tell you why it's a slippery slope. Senator Kennedy asked you about first-class mail. Has it been opened? And you declined answering. Let me ask this way. Has any other secret order or directive been issued by the President or any other senior administration official which authorizes conduct which would otherwise be prohibited by law? Yes or no will do.
Senator, the President has not authorized any conduct that I'm aware of that is in contravention of law.
Has the President ever invoked this authority with respect to any activity other than NSA surveillance?
Again, I'm not sure how to answer that question. And the President has exercised his authority to authorize this very targeted surveillance of international communications of the enemy. So I'm sorry, your question is?
Has the President ever invoked this authority with respect to any activity other than the program we're discussing, the NSA surveillance
Senator,
program?
Senator, I am not comfortable going down the road of saying yes or no as to what the President has or has not authorized.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. I just want to ask some others. If you don't want to answer them, don't answer them.
Yes, ma'am.
Can the President suspend the application of the Posse Comitatus Act?
Well, of course, Senator,
legally.
That is not what is at issue here.
I understand
this is not
that.
About law enforcement.
I'm
it's about foreign intelligence.
You choose not to answer it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Can the President suspend, in secret or otherwise, the application of Section 503 of the National Security Act, which states that no covert action may be conducted which is intended to influence United States political processes, public opinion, policies, or media? In other words, can he engage in otherwise illegal propaganda?
Senator, let me respond to – this is probably my response to all of your questions of these kind of hypotheticals. The question as to whether or not can Congress pass the statute that is in tension with a President's constitutional authority. Those are very, very difficult questions. And for me to answer those questions sort of off the cuff, I think would not be responsible. I think that again.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. I don't want to argue with you. All I'm trying to say is this is a slippery slope. Once you do one, there are a whole series of actions that can be taken, and I suspect the temptations to take them are very great. And we are either a nation that's that practices our rule of law, or we're not. Has any Supreme Court case since FISA held that the president can wiretap Americans once Congress has passed a law forbidding this without warrant?
I think the only case that comes to mind that's really pertinent would be the 2002 case from In Re sealed case by the FISA Court of Review, where the court, while the court did not decide this issue, the court acknowledged that every case that's considered this has found that the president has the inherent authority. And assuming that to be true, that court said that FISA could not encroach upon those authorities, those constitutional inherent authorities.
My time is up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Feinstein. Senator Sessions.
Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama.
Gonzalez, I believe you faithfully fulfilled your responsibility to give your best, honest answers to the questions so far. I think they've been very effective. If people have listened, I think they will feel much better about the program that the president has authorized and that you are explaining, because some of the news articles in particular gave the impression that there's widespread wiretapping of American citizens in domestic situations, and in every instance, there's an international call. Most of us, by plain language, would understand international to be different from domestic, and the president has limited this to international calls in which one or more parties are connected to al-Qaeda. Is that correct?
Sir, the program that I'm talking about today, yes, is limited to international calls.
And I'm sorry that there are those who would suggest that in previous testimony you may have not been truthful with the committee. I don't believe that's your reputation. I don't believe that's fair. I think you have a good answer to any of those charges. And I also think it's unfortunate that we're in a position where when the president is talking about the Patriot Act, just like we talk about the Patriot Act throughout the debate on the Patriot Act, we insisted that it did not authorize non-warrant wiretaps or searches. That's what we said about the Patriot Act because it didn't. So don't you think it's unfair to mix classified international surveillance issues with the Patriot Act debate?
Well, sir, I don't know if it's my place to characterize whether it's fair or unfair. I do believe that there is a difference, certainly in practice, and a difference recognizing the course between domestic surveillance and international surveillance.
Well, I think it's important for us to remember the world is hearing this. And so we have people suggesting the Attorney General of the United States and the President of the United States are deliberately lying, and it's not fair. It's not accurate. It's not true. So I think that's important. With regard to the briefing of Congress, the 8 members that have been designated to receive highly secret information were briefed on this program, were they not, Attorney General Gonzalez?
Sir, from the outset, bipartisan leadership of the Intel committees have been briefed in great detail about this, and there have also, in addition, been fewer briefings with respect to the bipartisan congressional leadership.
I would just note that, of course, there are 8 that hold those positions, but since the beginning of the program, at least 15 individuals have been in and out of those positions, including Tom Daschle, Bob Graham, Dick Gephardt, who are no longer in Congress, but were presumably part of that process. And were aware of it and participated in passing the FISA Act and believed that it was correct to go forward. I don't think they were hotboxed or few or forced into this. I believe they weighed these issues based on what they thought the national interest was and what the law was, and they made their decision not to object to this program. And there's been no formal objection by any of those members to this program. And I think it's unfair to suggest the president there has acted in secret without informing key members of Congress about this highly classified program.
Senator, I can't. Of course, I can't speak for the members of Congress, but to my knowledge, no one has asserted that the program should be stopped.
Well, I thought about the Super Bowl. There was some reference to the security intensity around that event, that police and Secret Service and every available federal and, I guess, state agency that could be brought into that were intensely aware that there could be an attack on the Super Bowl or any other major public event like that, but Super Bowl would be a prime target. Would you not agree of the Al-Qaeda types?
Clearly, we would have concerns that events like the Super Bowl would be ones that would be attractive to Al-Qaeda.
And intelligence is valuable to that. I mean, that's the key to it, and that's what we're trying to gather. And everybody understood after 9/11 that our failure was not in the capability to stop people. It was our capability to identify them. This program seems to me to be a step forward in our ability to identify them. And I believe, as you've explained it, it's consistent with our laws. With regard to statutory construction and how we should construe it, people have made the point that it's a general principle that a specific statute might control over a general statute. But isn't it true that if a general statute clearly contemplates certain actions and it can't be effective without those actions, then it would overrule the more specific earlier statute?
Depending on the circumstances, that would certainly be true, Senator. I might just also remind people, when you talk about general statutes versus specific statutes, this same argument was raised in connection with the Hamdi case, where you had a specific statute that said no American citizen could be detained except as otherwise authorized by statute. And the Supreme Court said that the authorization to use military force, even though it may have been characterized by some as a broad grant of authority, nonetheless, that was sufficient to override the prohibition in 4001A.
I think that's absolutely critical. I believe the Hamdi case is a pivotal authority here. After FISA, after the authorization of force on Al-Qaeda, an American citizen was detained without trial, and the Supreme Court of the United States held that since it was part of a military action in wartime, that person could be held without trial and as an incident to the authorization of force. Wouldn't you not agree that listening in on a conversation is less intrusive than putting an American citizen in jail?
It would certainly seem to me that it would be less intrusive. Just for the record, The language that I keep referring to, fundamental incident of waging war, was from Justice O'Connor. It is part of a plurality. And, of course, Justice Thomas, in essence, would have felt the president had the inherent authority under the Constitution to detain an American citizen. So I just want to make sure that we're accurate in the way we describe the decisions by the court.
Well, you've been very careful about those things, and we appreciate that. With regard to history, you made reference to our history. Isn't it true, of course, President Washington instructed his army to find ways to intercept letters from British operatives, that President Lincoln issued warrantless tapping of telegraph records, telegraph communications during the Civil War to try to identify troop movements of the enemy? Is it true that President Wilson authorized the military to intercept all telephone, telegraph, and telegraph traffic going into and out of the United States?
That's correct.
And that President Roosevelt instructed the government to use listening devices to learn the plans of spies in the United States, and that he gave the military the authority to access without review, without warrant, all telecommunications, quote, passing between the United States and any foreign country.
That is correct, sir.
What I would say to my colleagues and to the American people is, under FISA and other standards that we're using today, we are far more restraints on our military and the executive branch than history has demonstrated. We have absolutely not, we're not going hog wild restraining American liberties. In fact, the trend has been to provide more and more protections, and there can be a danger that we go too far in that and allow sleeper cells in this country to operate in a way that they're successful in killing American citizens that could have been intercepted and stopped.
Of course, Senator, we're doing everything we can to ensure that that doesn't happen.
But when you do domestic, well, I won't go into that. I want to ask you this question about that President Clinton's administration ordered several warrantless searches on the home and property of an alleged spy, Aldrich Ames. Actually, he was convicted. Isn't that true? And it also authorized a warrantless search of the Mississippi home of a suspected terrorist financier. And the Deputy Attorney General, Jamie Gorelick, the second in command of the Clinton Department of Justice, said this: the president has inherent authority to conduct warrantless physical searches for foreign intelligence purposes, and the rules and methodologies for criminal searches are inconsistent with the collection of foreign intelligence and would unduly frustrate the president in carrying out his foreign intelligence responsibilities. Are those comments relevant to the discussion we're having today?
As I understand it, that was her testimony. I think there was an acknowledgment that of the president's inherent constitutional authority. Now, of course, some would rightly say that in response to that, FISA was changed to include physical searches. And so the question is, again, that tees up, I think, a difficult constitutional issue, whether or not can the Congress constitutionally restrict the ability of the President of the United States to engage in surveillance of the enemy during a time of war. Fortunately, I don't think we need to answer that question. I think in this case, the Congress has authorized the President to use all necessary and appropriate force, which would include the electronic surveillance of the enemy.
But Deputy Attorney General Gorelick in the Clinton administration defending these searches, she asserted it was a constitutional power of the president, and this was in a period of peace, not even in war. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. We'll now take a luncheon break, and we'll resume at 1:45.
Yes, sir.
You're listening to special coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearings with witness Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General of the United States, on warrantless wiretapping, and this is NPR News. I'm Neil Conan, along with NPR Legal Affairs Correspondent Nina Totenberg and NPR National Security Correspondent Jackie Northam. And Nina Totenberg, as we've been listening to these last few exchanges in this first round of questions from the 18 members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, a lot of questions coming up about congressional notification, and Democrats saying you haven't notified Congress, and of course Republicans saying, of course, you briefed members of Congress.
They did brief members of Congress. They briefed what's called the Gang of Eight, which is the chairman and ranking member of the Senate and House Intelligence Committee and the Republican and Democratic leadership. The problem is that of the eight people they briefed, first of all, two of them, both Democrats, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller, and Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader in the House, both wrote letters saying they had grave concerns about the legality of the program, but they're sworn to secrecy. There's nothing they can do about it. Apparently, they briefed also the chief judge of the FISA court, and she had some reservations about some of the things that they were doing, but there's nothing she could do about it, and she couldn't tell her fellow judges.
Because of the secrecy.
So the statute says that the committee must be informed. It's unclear whether that means everybody on the committee, but in any event, if you absolutely thought this was an illegal program, there really wouldn't be much you could do about it except write a letter, because you're not supposed to tell anybody else about it.
And which is, in fact, Congresswoman Pelosi and Senator Rockefeller did. They wrote letters. In fact, Congressman Rockefeller's handwritten letter, because he couldn't go out of the room to use a typewriter or even a word processor, has since been made public. There's also a distinction here. We're hearing Alberto Gonzalez being grilled, early in the Bush administration. He was White House counsel, and also subsequently in his role now as Attorney General. Is there a distinction between those two roles?
Well, they're very different, but in this particular instance, I'm not sure there's a huge distinction because he's gone from being the president's White House lawyer, who at that point was somewhat at odds eventually with some people in the Justice Department, to now being in the Justice Department and providing the legal rationales for doing these kinds of things. I think there are two other small things I want to clear up.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie Gorelick, the Deputy Attorney General in the Clinton administration, testified about the president's inherent power at the time they were asking to amend FISA, because apparently Attorney General Janet Reno was extremely uncomfortable authorizing these black bag jobs, and she wanted it put into law. So they did amend FISA to allow physical searches. And lastly, you've heard a lot about the Hamdi decision. This was the decision by the Supreme Court, which upheld the right of the president to detain American citizens captured on the battlefield. Court has not yet resolved whether you can just detain American citizens. But the administration was asserting the right to hold people indefinitely incommunicado without charge, and the court, by an 8-1 vote, said that that could not be done, that you had to provide charge, some sort of due process, etc.
Joining us now is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy of Vermont. Senator, thanks very much for coming up to join us here in the booth.
Thank you. Good to be with you. At least all the emails I'm getting from Vermont, apparently a number of people are listening to you.
As you've been listening to the Attorney General, first in his opening statement and then in response to questions from the senators, including yourself, have you got a clearer understanding now of the legal rationale that the administration has been using to support its terrorist surveillance program, as it likes to call it?
Well, they call it a terrorist surveillance program. I say the terrorist surveillance program, of course, is a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that we passed and updated and which the president should be following. He's not following. No, I don't have a clearer view. I've asked Attorney General Gonzalez, who was first the president's counsel and would know exactly when the president began this warrantless spying. I asked him when it began. Did it begin before the Patriot Act? Did it begin after the Patriot Act? Did it begin before 9/11? Did it begin afterward? And he doesn't know. So I made it very clear that I want him to get that answer. He's got a dozen or more people from the Justice Department down there. I'll let them get the answer during the lunch hour, and I'll ask it again. Because you really can't have an answer without that. I have heard a number of the White House talking points, the most recent witness doing that, reading them back. That doesn't answer the question. It sort of sets up as though somehow, if you're asking these questions, you're on the side of the terrorists. We all want to get rid of the terrorists. All of us go to work every day in a building, the Capitol building, that was targeted by the terrorists. Of course we want to get them. But we want to make sure that you don't set up a thing where somehow the president can pick and choose which laws he'll follow and can pick and choose when he wants to be above the law.
Senator, there have been a number of questions that your colleagues on the Democratic side in particular have asked, and frankly, they seem to have been satisfied with not much of an answer. For example, Senator Cole asked Attorney General Gonzalez if he would agree to a retroactive approval by the FISA court, if this is really necessary. And his answer was that the administration would consider that. But have there been any serious talks with the administration about amending the law to provide what some of you on the Democratic side, and I think Senator Spector and perhaps Senator Brownback and Senator Graham think are possibilities for abuse? Maybe there hasn't been abuse, but possibilities for abuse, so that there's some sort of a check on this kind of executive power.
The irony is that there hasn't been any request from the administration for changes. In fact, I think it was in 2002 when Senator DeWine suggested some changes. They said, no, we don't need them. That may go too far. Well, they obviously did not go anywhere near as far as they're going. And they've miscited things. They talk about the Hamdi case, as you've already pointed out. Hamdi was captured on the battlefield. He was captured in Afghanistan. It wasn't a question of having the laws that we use inside the United States involving either Americans or otherwise, that wasn't the question. He was captured on the battlefield. The Hamdi case, is the thing that we get out of that in the Supreme Court, was what Justice O'Connor said. No one, not even the president, is above the law. We're asking about warrantless searches here. I mean, could the president say, okay, I want to wire, you know, we have a real problem with organized crime in America. Let's just go ahead. That eventually affects our security. Let's wiretap them. So far, the Attorney General has not answered those questions. We've heard the talking points that the White House provides. They quote Jamie Gorelick. One of the letters I put in the record this morning was from her, pointing out it's being taken totally out of context. And in fact, they were coming in to say, we want a change in FISA so we can make searches in foreign intelligence matters here in the United States.
Senator, let me ask you something. Some of this is very confusing because there's no question that under FISA, even without a warrant, if there's an international call between an American citizen and an al-Qaeda-connected person, that conversation can be eavesdropped on electronically without a warrant. And then if there's further need to surveil the American, there is at least 72 hours to go get a warrant. So one suspects that there's more here than meets the eye and that what we're talking about may be data mining, that what NSA is doing is looking at calling patterns and picking out certain patterns. And based on those patterns, that's not enough to get a warrant, there's enough there to want to pursue.
Well, so far what's been going on, we found out more from the press than we have from the administration. They've been unwilling to tell us what they're doing. Of course, they have the ability to data mine up, but they've come up here several times with the carnivore program, with the TIPS program, with some other things. They've come to the Congress, and the Congress, overwhelmingly, Republicans and Democrats say, no, Americans don't want you to data mine where they go on the internet, what sites they're going on, what kind of emails they're sending around. Partly the furor we saw when they wanted a week's worth of activities on Google. This we do believe in our security, but we also believe in our privacy in this country. I worry that maybe what they're trying to do is make up for mistakes before 9/11. Now, they did have the information. They did know who most of the hijackers were, and they lost it before 9/11. And this is the administration that on September 10th were making proposals to cut back considerably on the amount of money they had in counterterrorism. And then on September 12th, of course, they wanted more. I wish they had connected the dots. I wish the administration had done a better job before September 11th. But I think I can speak for all Americans. We don't want another September 11th. We want them to do well. But simply saying, let us decide how to do it. Sort of like what they said with Homeland Security. Don't worry. We've set up. We're fine. Well, we found out how poorly they did that with Katrina. We want to know what they're doing here. Are they just simply saying we want this power grab, or are we actually protecting America?
Do you need to know what they're doing? Or as Senator Specter suggested, if they brought this entire program before the FISA court and let the FISA court review it, would that be adequate?
I want to know that they're following the law. And if the law needs changes, that we know what those changes are and we do it. They keep talking about all the people that they've talked to about changing the law. The Judiciary Committee decides which laws, at least initially for the Senate. Nobody's been talked to in our committee about changing these laws. We want to know what's going on, what's happened in this, as in the torture statute and other things. They say, well, you know, war, terrorists, give us a free hand. There are no checks and balances. We're above the law. The country doesn't work that way. Ultimately, we're better off if we're working together. We all want to stop the terrorists. We all want to make sure that the mistakes are not made that were made before by the administration. And so let's work together, not working at cross purposes. And so far, I don't think the Attorney General has been as forthcoming as I wish he would be.
You know, we had this business about swearing him in the very beginning of the hearing. You wanted to swear him in. Senator Spector didn't want to swear him in. Is he still accountable under law for the truthfulness of what he says if he's not sworn in?
Well, he's accountable under law, but, you know, sometimes being sworn in really focuses the attention. And I had heard, just because Senator Spector had said in an earlier hearing that he intended to swear everybody in. As you know, he swore in Attorney General Gonzales, which is traditional for his confirmation. But then he came here with FBI Director Mueller. He swore them both in. This was on an oversight hearing last April. I think it would have been wise to have done this, especially after the press pointed out that his answer to a question by Senator Feingold in April.
His referring to Attorney General Gonzales.
Yeah, Attorney General Gonzales's answer to Senator Feingold was anything but forthright.
Senator, how late do you think we're going to go today?
We haven't gone through the first round of questions. There'll be more. This could be late. But, you know, this is important enough. We should go as long as it takes. And then we should call in others. You know, there have been a number of key Republicans who have said, this is not right. We're not doing this right. Key Republicans who have been in the administration, they want to testify. They should be able to testify. Again, it's not a question whether we like the terrorists or not. We all hate the terrorists. We all want to catch the terrorists. But at the end, we want to make sure that the liberties that we spent 225 years in protecting in this country are still protected.
Senator, thanks so much. We appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. His first round of questions was held earlier this morning here in Washington. We're in the Hart Senate office building. Well, you may have seen it on TV during the hearings for that now Chief Justice John Roberts and now Supreme Court Associate Justice Samuel Alito. It's the same building and the same hearing room where the Judiciary Committee is grilling today. Alberto Gonzales, the Attorney General of the United States, also asking him about earlier time in the administration when he was White House counsel.
The next senator up is Russell Feingold, who has sent a letter to General Gonzales saying that he was misled during the confirmation hearings when he testified about wiretapping statutes.
This was among the clips of video information Democrats
right.
had hoped to play before the committee. Again, the ruling from the chair, that being Senator Spector, that's not necessary, and then indeed the actual transcripts. But in any case, Senator Spector spoke on television yesterday about the importance of the testimony that then Attorney General-designate Alberto Gonzales gave to Senator Feingold when he was asking about whether there were any hypothetical circumstances where warrantless wiretapping was going on. Anyway, we'll get to that after the senators return from their break at lunch. We're going to join them at lunch and return when the senators return at, that will be 1:45 Eastern Time. I'm Neil Conan. This is special coverage from NPR News.
And this is AM 580 WILL, Urbana Public Radio, coming to you from the campus of the University of Illinois. Good morning. My name is David Inge. With me here in the studio is Jay Pierce, station manager for WILL. And we will break here as National Public Radio is pausing in their coverage. In just a few minutes, we'll get on to a portion of our usual noon hour. Celeste Quinn and the news staff is standing by, and then we'll rejoin National Public Radio at 1:45 as they resume coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearing. In the meantime, we would like to speak to you about supporting this radio station. We are here now embarked on our February fundraising effort. This is now the second time that we have come to you at this time of year asking for your support. And it became necessary last year because of the budget situation to spend a little more time than we have in the past asking you for your support on the air. And we have found over the years that while there are people that support us loyally, year after year, it is very important for us as time goes by to encourage new folks, people who, for whatever reason, maybe you have just discovered WILL, maybe in the past you couldn't afford it in your budget, for whatever reason, we need to encourage new folks in to be supporters of WILL. And we have found that by far the best way to do it is simply to ask, to sit in front of the microphones and do that. So a couple of times during the year, we take the opportunity to do that. And now it would be a great chance for you. The hearings aren't going on. You're not going to miss any news, weather, sports, anything like that. All of that coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. Right now,
If this is something that's on your list to do this week, take the opportunity to do it. We have the volunteers. It'll take a minute or two of your time, and it's real important to the future of this radio station. And after all that talking, I better give the phone number.
You better.
244-9455 is the number to call to make a pledge, and 217 is the area code. We're hoping to raise $6,000 today, and we can find out here in a moment how we're doing. You were on a little bit earlier this morning talking about supporting the station. Then we went to the hearings.
That's right. Well, you're the one who asks the questions.
Well, maybe you might want to talk for a minute or two about what the budget situation
sure.
looks like, particularly because I know that for a long time, going back some months now, we did not know what the federal funding picture was going to look like mm-hmm. because the Congress hadn't yet passed the budget. And I recall even having been on television during Winterfest back in December. And still at that time, we were saying, folks, we don't know what the federal money is going to be like. Do we now know what
yeah,
it
we
is?
Do. And you might remember at the beginning of the summer, last summer, we faced the potential of some rather devastating cuts. But thanks to listeners contacting lawmakers and letting them know the value that they placed in public broadcasting, we went through several cycles of restoration and rescission and restoration and rescission. And when all was said and done, last month, as a matter of fact, the news came out that the appropriations bill was done and signed, and we got our funding for the current fiscal year that began in October. And public broadcasting is funded a couple of years in advance. Well, they were basically going back on the word of a couple of years ago in cutting the funding for the current fiscal year. But it was restored. That's good news. But, of course, the president just delivered a new budget to Congress for them to start thinking about for the next fiscal year. And it calls for some cuts. So here we go again in this roller coaster of federal funding. This year it's up. And that's good news. So we applaud you and your efforts to contact your lawmakers and let them know what you think about public broadcasting. Could it be up again next year? Is it going to be down? What's going to happen? Well, you know, that's the uncertainty. The thing that we can do about it, though, is to have consistent listener support at 217-244-9455. That's the one thing that helps us to maintain that margin of excellence that that brings you David Inge and Focus 580, Celeste Quinn and the Afternoon Magazine and other programs unique to WILL Radio. We're in a good situation right now with the budget. It's balanced. For the first time in several years, I can honestly say we're going to end the year and not be in deficit. And we've used our reserves. So the good news is that it will be balanced. Now, what did it take to balance the budget? Well, you've worked here a long time. What have the last 5 years been like compared to 5 years right before that?
Extremely, extremely tight. And I think that one of the things that we have had to do and you've had to do as manager is to look for corners to cut. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have thought that there would have been that many corners. But, you know, we cut everything just to the absolute bone that we possibly could.
Yeah.
So that's what and we have tried to do it as much as possible. I know, as you have said, as without cutting any of what we consider to be the core service.
The quick.
That we do. We have cut some things and we have been disappointed there were some things that we have had to cut. But we have tried to at least maintain the essentials and do it, make those cuts in a way that would be least noticeable to the listeners. The problem maybe is that we've done it in ways that's least noticeable to the listeners. Mm-hmm. We have tried to preserve the service, and perhaps sometimes people haven't really gotten the message just how critical the funding situation has been.
Yeah.
We've tried to give that message to you.
But we don't believe that the proper method would be to cut things just to cut them to prove a point. We wait till it's absolutely necessary to make those decisions. So you know, we think that's the best way to go. 244-9455. We're logging on to willpledge.org. Will help us to sustain the programming that you depend on right now and build in the future. That's what it's all about. Yeah, shall we go into Pledge Central?
Let's do that here. Kim Cronick is standing by in Pledge Central. She's someone who, in her professional work here, spends a lot of time thinking about getting us involved in the community. I know that's something that's important to her because I've had many conversations with her about that. What's happening down there in Pledge Central?
Well, we have community involvement. We have listener involvement. We have Beth and Dorcas and Audrey volunteering their time to take your call, and Valerie, our staff member here, and Beth's taking a call. So we've got a listener calling in with a pledge right now, and we so appreciate that. We want to raise $6,000 by today, and we're a little over the $4,000 mark, so that's really
great.
Good. So we would like you to call in at 244-9455, and we have a special incentive if you can become a new member of WILL. We'll give you a $10 gift certificate, courtesy of World Harvest Foods, located at 519 East University Avenue in Champaign. Why? Well, because World Harvest Food wants to encourage our listeners to become supporters. So if you've never made a pledge, call right now, 217-244-9455. You know, World Harvest is a great place to shop, and WILL is a great place to listen. I'd like to suggest a $75 pledge for folks. You get that wonderful WILL AM-FM stainless steel travel mug. You also get the member benefit card, which gives you two-for-one savings at more than 335 restaurants, bed and breakfasts across the country, actually, and Canada. So there's lots of good reasons to support WILL. We're just taking a short break from those hearings. We try to bring you the coverage live, wall-to-wall. That's a service we provide that other stations just cannot do. So we know you value it. You're the piece in the puzzle that we need to hear from. We've got businesses. We've got volunteers calling in. We'd love to hear from new pledgers, new listeners who will become a member for the first time right now today. We so appreciate that. 217-244-9455. Help us reach that goal of $6,000 raised today with your pledge.
Well, that's the message. Well, thank you very much, Kim, and thanks to our program director, Jay Pierce. We're going to get you back on the regular clock here. We'll have news, some other things, features, weather, all as part of at least a portion of the first hour of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. And as David mentioned, we will return to NPR for live coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on President Bush's domestic eavesdropping program at 12:45 p.m. Central Time. So coming up in the noon hour, we will have news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580, and Mike Sola will have weather at 12:35. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. March Kansas wheat trading in fast-track mode at 418 and a quarter, up 6 3/4. Chicago March wheat, 356 and a half, unchanged. May, 367 and 3/4, unchanged. March corn, 223 and a half, down 1 3/4. May, 233 and a half, down 1 1/2. July, 242 and a quarter, down 1 3/4. December, 258 and a half, down 1 1/2. March beans, 588, that down 6 3/4.